Salaminius Hermias Sozomenus, The Ecclesiastical History. The Ecclesiastical History. Book 1. Chapter 1- The preface of the book, in which he investigates the history of the Jewish nation, mention of those who began such a work, how and from what sources he collected his history, how he was intent upon the truth, and what other details the history will contain. My mind has been often exercised in inquiring how it is that other men are very ready to believe in God the Word, while the Jews are so incredulous, although it was to them that instruction concerning the things of God was, from the beginning, imparted by the prophets, who likewise made them acquainted with the events attendant upon the coming of Christ, before they came to pass. 1. Besides, Abraham, the founder of their nation and of the circumcision, was accounted worthy to be an eyewitness, and the host of the Son of God. 2. And Isaac, his son, was honored as the type of the sacrifice on the cross, for he was led bound to the altar by his father and, as accurate students of the sacred scriptures affirm, the sufferings of Christ came to pass in like manner. Jacob predicted that the expectation of the nations would be for Christ, as it now is, and he likewise foretold the time in which he came, when he said the rulers of the Hebrews of the tribe of Judah, the tribal leader, shall fail. 3. This dearly referred to the reign of Herod, who was an Idumean, on his father's side, and on his mother's, an Arabian, and the Jewish nation was delivered to him by the Roman Senate and Augustus Caesar. And of the rest of the prophets, some declared beforehand the birth of Christ, his ineffable conception, the mother remaining a virgin after his birth, his people, and country. 4. Some predicted his divine arid marvelous deeds, while others foretold his sufferings, his resurrection from the dead, his ascension into the heavens, and the event accompanying each. But if any be ignorant of these facts, it is not difficult to know them by reading the sacred books. Josephus, the son of Matthias, also who was a priest, and was most distinguished among Jews and Romans, may be regarded as a noteworthy witness to the truth concerning Christ. 5. For he hesitates to call him a man, since he wrought marvelous works, and was a teacher of truthful doctrines, but openly calls him Christ, that he was condemned to the death of the cross, and appeared alive again the third day. Nor was Josephus ignorant of numberless other wonderful predictions uttered beforehand by the holy prophets concerning Christ. He further testifies that Christ brought over many to himself, both Greeks and Jews, who continued to love him, and that the people named after him had not become extinct. It appears to me that in narrating these things, he all but proclaims that Christ, by comparison of works, is God. As if struck by the miracle, he ran, somehow, a middle course, assailing in no way those who believed in Jesus, but rather agreeing with them. When I consider this matter, it seems reasonably remarkable to me, that the Hebrews did not anticipate, and, before the rest of men, immediately turn to Christianity. For though the Sibyl and some oracles announced beforehand the future of events concerning Christ, we are not on this account to attribute unbelief to all the Greeks, for they were few, who, appearing superior in education, could understand such prophecies, which were, for the most part, in verse, and were declared with more recondite words to the people. Therefore, in my judgment, it was the result of the heavenly pre-knowledge, for the sake of the agreement in future events, that the coming facts were to be made known, not only by his own prophets, but in part also by strangers. Just as a musician, under pressure of a strange melody, may treat the superfluous tones of the chords lightly with his plectrum, or add others to those already existing. Having now shown that the Hebrews, although in the possession of numerous and more distinct prophecies concerning the coming of Christ, were less willing than the Greeks to embrace the faith that is in him, let what has been said on the subject suffice. Yet let it by no means be hence accounted contrary to reason that the church should have been mainly built up by the conversion of other nations, for in the first place, it is evident that, in divine and great affairs, God delights to bring to pass changes in a marvelous manner, and then, be it remembered, it was by the exercise of no common virtues that those who, at the very beginning, were at the head of religious affairs, maintained their influence. If they did not, indeed, possess a language sharpened for expression or for beauty of diction, nor the power of convincing their hearers by means of phrases or mathematical demonstrations, yet they did not the less accomplish the work they had undertaken. They gave up their property, neglected their kindred, were stretched upon a cross, and as if endowed with bodies not their own, suffered many and excruciating tortures, neither seduced by the adulation of the people and rulers of any city, nor terrified by their menaces, they clearly evidenced by their conduct that they were supported in the struggle by the hope of a high reward, so that they, in fact, needed not to resort to verbal arguments, for without any effort on their part, their very deeds constrained the inhabitants of every house and of every city to give credit to their testimony, even before they knew wherein it consisted. Since then so divine and marvelous a change has taken place in the circumstances of men, that ancient cults and national laws have fallen into contempt, since many of the most celebrated writers among the Greeks have tasked their powers of eloquence in describing the Clydonian boar, the bull of Marathon and other similar prodigies, which have really occurred in countries or cities, or have a mystic origin. Why should not I rise above myself, and write a history of the church? For I am persuaded that, as the topic is not the achievements of men, it may appear almost incredible that such a history should be written by me. But, with God, nothing is impossible. I at first felt strongly inclined to trace the course of events from the very commencement, but on reflecting that similar records of the past up to their own time had been compiled by those wisest of men, Clemens, 1, and Hegesippus, successors of the apostles, by Africanus the historian, and by Eusebius, surnamed Pamphilus, 2, a man intimately acquainted with the sacred scriptures and the writings of the Greek poets and historians, I merely draw up an epitome in two books of all that is recorded to have happened to the churches, from the ascension of Christ to the deposition of Licinius. 3. Now, however, by the help of God, I will endeavor to relate the subsequent events as well. I shall record the transactions with which I have been connected, and also those concerning which I have heard from persons who knew or saw the affairs in our own day or before our own generation. But I have sought for records of events of earlier date, amongst the established laws appertaining to religion, amongst the proceedings of the synods of the period, amongst the innovations that arose, and in the epistles of kings and priests. Some of these documents are preserved in palaces and churches, and others are dispersed and in the possession of the learned. I thought frequently of transcribing the whole, but on further reflection I deemed it better, on account of the mass of the documents, to give merely a brief synopsis of their contents. Yet whenever controverted topics are introduced, I will readily transcribe freely from any work that may tend to the elucidation of truth. If anyone who is ignorant of past events should conclude my history to be false, because he meets with conflicting statements in other writings, let him know that since the dogmas of Arius and other more recent hypotheses have been broached, the rulers of the churches, differing in opinion among themselves, have transmitted in writing their own peculiar views, for the benefit of their respective followers. And further, be it remembered, these rulers convened councils and issued what decrees they pleased, often condemning unheard those whose greed was dissimilar to their own, and striving to their utmost to induce the reigning prince and nobles of the time to side with them, intent upon maintaining the orthodoxy of their own dogmas. The partisans of each sect respectively formed a collection of such epistles as favored their own heresy, omitting all documents of a contrary tendency. Such are the obstacles by which we are beset in our endeavors to arrive at a conclusion on this subject. Still, as it is requisite, in order to maintain historical accuracy, to pay the strictest attention to the means of eliciting truth, I felt myself bound to examine all writings of this class according to my ability. Let not an impertinent or malignant spirit be imputed to me, for having dwelt upon the disputes of ecclesiastics among themselves, concerning the primacy and the preeminence of their own heresy. In the first place, as I have already said, an historian ought to regard everything as secondary in importance to truth. Moreover, The doctrine of the Catholic Church is shown to be especially the most genuine, since it has been tested frequently by the plots of opposing thinkers. Yet, the disposal of the lot being of God, the Catholic Church has maintained its own ascendancy, has reassumed its own power, and has led all the churches and the people to the reception of its own truth. I have had to deliberate whether I ought to confine myself to the recital of events connected with the Church under the Roman government, but it seemed more advisable to include, as far as possible, the record of transactions relative to religion among the Persians and barbarians. Nor is it foreign to ecclesiastical history to introduce in this work an account of those who were the fathers and originators of what is denominated monarchism, and of their immediate successors, whose celebrity is well known to us either by observation or report. For I would neither be considered ungracious, one, towards them, nor willing to consign their virtue to oblivion, nor yet be thought ignorant of their history. But I would wish to leave behind me such a record of their manner of life that others, led by their example, might attain to a blessed and happy end. As the work proceeds, these subjects shall be noted as far as possible. Invoking the help and propitiousness of God, I now proceed to the narration of events. The present history shall have its beginning from this point. Chapter 2. Of the bishops of the large towns in the reign of Constantine, and how, from fear of Licinius, Christianity was professed cautiously in the east as far as Libya, while in the west, through the favor of Constantine, it was professed with freedom. During the consulate of Constantine Caesar and Crispus Caesar, Sylvester governed the Church of Rome, Alexander, that of Alexandria, and Macarius, that of Jerusalem. Not one, since Romanus, had been appointed over the church of Antioch on the Ontes, for the persecution, it appears, had prevented the ceremony of ordination from taking place. The bishops assembled at Nicaea not long after were, however, so sensible of the purity of the life and doctrines of Astathius, that they adjudged him worthy to fill the apostolic see, although he was then bishop of the neighboring Borea. They translated him to Antioch. 3. The Christians of the East, as far as Libya on the borders of Egypt, did not dare to meet openly as a church, for Licinius had withdrawn his favor from them. But the Christians of the West, the Greeks, the Macedonians, and the Arians, met for worship in safety through the protection of Constantine, who was then at the head of the Roman Empire. 4. Chapter 3. By the vision of the crosses, and by the appearance of Christ, Constantine is led to embrace Christianity. He receives religious instruction from our brethren. We have been informed that Constantine was led to honor the Christian religion by the concurrence of several different events, particularly by the appearance of a sign from heaven. When he first formed the resolution of entering into a war against Maxentius, he was beset with doubts as to the means of carrying on his military operations, and as to the quarter whence he could look for assistance. In the midst of his perplexity, he saw, in a vision, the sight of the cross, 5, shining in heaven. He was amazed at the spectacle, but some holy angels who were standing by, exclaimed, "O, Constantine, by this symbol, conquer." And it is said that Christ himself appeared to him, and showed him the symbol of the cross, and commanded him to construct one like unto it, and to retain it as his help in battle, as it would ensure the victory. Eusebius, surnamed Pamphilus, 6, affirms that he heard the emperor declare with an oath, as the sun was on the point of inclining about the middle of the day, he and the soldiers who were with him saw in heaven the trophy of the cross composed of light, and encircled by the following words, "By this sign, conquer." This vision met him by the way, when he was perplexed as to whither he should lead his army. While he was reflecting on what this could mean, night came, and when he fell asleep, Christ appeared, 1, with the sign which he had seen in heaven, and commanded him to construct a representation of the symbol, and to use it as his help in hostile encounters. There was nothing further to be elucidated, for the emperor clearly apprehended the necessity of serving God. At daybreak, 2, he called together the priests of Christ, and questioned them concerning their doctrines. They opened the sacred scriptures, and expounded the truths relative to Christ, and showed him from the prophets, how the signs which had been predicted had been fulfilled. The sign which had appeared to him was the symbol, they said, of the victory over hell, for Christ came among men, was stretched upon the cross, died, and returned to life the third day. On this account, they said, there was hope that at the close of the present dispensation, there would be a general resurrection of the dead, and entrance upon immortality, when those who had led a good life would receive accordingly, and those who had done evil would be punished. Yet, continued they, the means of salvation and of purification from sin are provided, namely, for the uninitiated, 8, initiation according to the canons of the Church, and for the initiated, abstinence from renewed sin. But as few, even among holy men, are capable of complying with this latter condition, another method of purification is set forth, namely, repentance, for God, in His love towards man, bestows forgiveness on those who have fallen into sin, on their repentance, and the confirmation of their repentance by good works. Chapter 4. Constantine commands the sign of the crosses to be carried before him in battle. An extraordinary narrative about the bearers of the sign of the crosses. The emperor, amazed at the prophecies concerning Christ which were expounded to him by the priests, sent for some skillful artisans, and commanded them to remodel the standard called by the Romans Labarum, for, to convert it into a representation of the cross, and to adorn it with gold and precious stones. This warlike trophy was valued beyond all others, for it was always wont to be carried before the emperor, and was worshipped by the soldiery. I think that Constantine changed the most honorable symbol of the Roman power into the sign of Christ, chiefly that by the habit of having it always in view, and of worshipping it, the soldiers might be induced to abandon their ancient forms of superstition, and to recognize the true God, whom the emperor worshipped, as their leader and their help in battle, for this symbol was always borne in front of his own troops, and was, at the command of the emperor, carried among the phalanxes in the thickest of the fight by an illustrious band of spearmen, of whom each one in turn took the standard upon his shoulders, and paraded it through the ranks. It is said that on one occasion, on an unexpected movement of the hostile forces, the man who held the standard in terror, placed it in the hands of another, and secretly fled from the battle. When he got beyond the reach of the enemy's weapons, he suddenly received a wound and fell, while the man who had stood by the divine symbol remained unhurt, although many weapons were aimed at him, for the missiles of the enemy, marvelously directed by divine agency, lighted upon the standard, and the bearer thereof, although in the midst of danger, was preserved. It is also asserted that no soldier who bore this standard in battle ever fell, through any dark calamity, such as is wont to happen to the soldiery in war, or was wounded, or taken prisoner. Chapter 5. Refutation of the assertion that Constantine became a Christian in consequence of the murder of his son Crispus. I am aware that it is reported by the pagans that Constantine, after slaying some of his nearest relations, and particularly after assenting to the murder of his own son Crispus, repented of his evil deeds, and inquired of Sopater, 5, the philosopher, who was then master of the school of Plotinus, concerning the means of purification from guilt. The philosopher, so the story goes, replied that such moral defilement could admit of no purification. The emperor was grieved at this repulse, but happening to meet with some bishops who told him that he would be cleansed from sin, on repentance and on submitting to baptism, he was delighted with their representations, and admired their doctrines, and became a Christian, and led his subjects to the same faith. It appears to me that this story was the invention of persons who desired to vilify the Christian religion. Crispus, 6, on whose account, it is said, Constantine required purification, did not die till the 20th year of his father's reign. He held the second place in the empire and bore the name of Caesar, and many laws, framed with his sanction in favor of Christianity, are still extant. That this was the case can be proved by referring to the dates affixed to these laws, and to the lists of the legislators. It does not appear likely that Sopater had any intercourse with Constantine, whose government was then centered in the regions near the ocean and the Rhine, for his dispute with Maxentius, the governor of Italy, had created so much dissension in the Roman dominions, that it was then no easy matter to dwell in Gaul, in Britain, or in the neighboring countries, in which it is universally admitted Constantine embraced the religion of the Christians, previous to his war with Maxentius, and prior to his return to Rome and Italy, and this is evidenced by the dates of the laws which he enacted in favor of religion. But even granting that Sopater chanced to meet the emperor, or that he had epistolary correspondence with him, it cannot be imagined the philosopher was ignorant that Hercules, the son of Alcmena, obtained purification at Athens by the celebration of the mysteries of Ceres after the murder of his children, and of Iphitus, his guest and friend. That the Greeks held that purification from guilt of this nature could be obtained, is obvious from the instance I have just alleged, and he is a false calumniator who represents that Sopater taught the contrary. I cannot admit the possibility of the philosopher's having been ignorant of these facts, for he was at that period esteemed the most learned man in Greece.